This episode is sponsored by World History Encyclopedia, one of the top history websites on the internet. I love the fact they're not a wiki. Every article they publish is reviewed by the editorial team, not only for being accurate, but also for being interesting to read. The website is run as a non-profit organization, so you won't be bombarded by annoying ads, and is completely free. It's a great site, and don't just take my word for it. They've been recommended by many academic institutions, including Oxford University. Go check them out at worldhistory.org or follow the link in the episode description. In 1913, newly qualified physician Albert Schweitzer decided to wave goodbye to an easy life in Europe and made his way to the jungles of French Equatorial Africa with the intention of building a hospital within the colony of Gabon. It was a remarkable move, given Schweitzer, as a talented organist and theologian, not to mention doctor, could have become quite wealthy had he remained in Alsace-Lorraine. It's also worth pointing out that just a few years before he went there, the very worst excesses of colonialism had been exposed after the King of Belgium turned the neighbouring Congo into a huge plantation run with the same kind of brutality as a concentration camp. Meanwhile, the Germans had committed what later came to be viewed as a genocide within their own colony in Southwest Africa. So to say Schweitzer was ahead of his times in terms of his views on colonialism, race and, well, human decency is something of an understatement. 70 years later, another outsider, American Eric Madine, now an award-winning author whose varied work has resulted in him being described as unclassifiable in terms of genre, followed in Schweitzer's footsteps. In this episode, I speak with Eric about the legacy he found the Nobel Prize-winning Schweitzer had left behind, his own experiences in the country, and the impact it had on him as a writer. How did Schweitzer's hospital, I mean, considering it was built in the middle of the jungle, so presumably there were issues with resources for building, among other things, how did it compare with what people would have been used to in the Western world in terms of a hospital at the time?
It was in a town called Lambaréné, and he went up the Ogooué River looking for where he was going to start and plant his missionary hospital. The site itself is up a hill, kind of on a high shelf of land above the Ogooué River, which kind of meanders through the whole of the country. This was very remote, considering the date he started back in 1913. He carved the bush out to build his hospital little by little, as the French say, petit à petit, oiseau fait son nid. Little by little, the bird builds its nest, and what an awesome nest he built. Wow. Throughout Schweitzer's reign there, it was a standout in the level of care that he and his staff were able to give. It was never, after his death, adopted into the Gabonese healthcare system, so it functioned by itself. And Schweitzer got kind of a bad rap for not transferring the medical skills to the Gabonese. But I'd like to explain in a little detail about how difficult it would be to transfer the complexities of Western medicine to the Gabonese people, who at that time were educated in forest schools, learning traditional Gabonese culture and being initiated into adulthood with no math or science, and to have to educate them in the complexities of, say, administering a drop feed or inoculations, etc., would be the straw that would break the camel's back, because Schweitzer was extremely busy. He was a polymath, not only a medical doctor, but a philosopher, a missionary on mission in the Lutheran tradition, a musicologist, an organist, And as an organist, he gave recitals mainly in Europe so as to fund his ho hospital. And out of pride, he didn't take donations. So he gets a bad rap there. And I just don't think he had the time to go back to teach all those rudimentary subjects that are required of Western medicine. I think he had a heart of gold, and he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1952 for his strenuous efforts over so many years.
How did the locals think about this strange foreign individual who suddenly showed up in their lands and built its hospital?
We were taught to say host country nationals, not natives, not local people. But anyway, let's call them the Gabonese. And they looked up to him in respectfully and exotically too, because he was the first white they had ever seen. They viewed him as an exotic and something of, well, as the Gabonese say in French, a vampire, or il était vampire. He was bewitched because he had, from their point of view, kind of a magical touch for healing, because Western medicine, of course, was unbeknownst to the Gabonese at that time. So he had that aura of being kind of a wizard.
What were your first impressions when you arrived in Gabon and went to Schweitzer's hospital?
Well, at that time, this was 1981, and I had just graduated from the University of Arizona, and I joined the Peace Corps. But my first impressions were kind of bifurcated in that most of the people dressed Western, most of the Gabonese. Yet, upon scratching the surface, you found completely different culture there, and very much into the oral tradition, emerging of literacy thrown in, especially among the young people. And the way the people spoke was so powerful and articulate, and they spoke in a voice from deep within. The precision of language was very much there. To give you an example, later, when I was in the village where I was building a school, primary school complex, I went out with a worker, and the chainsaw we borrowed from a villager wasn't working, was kind of running backward. And we tried to cut this muwabi, a precious hardwood, for pillars of the school. And we came back to the, we couldn't do it because it wasn't geared right. And my friend, Pierre, a Gabonese village friend and a worker, explained to another friend in French, "Ona gratte le muwabi," meaning we scratch the muwabi. And that poetic precision and was so moving. So we had this kind of literacy with orality combined, and it was quite moving, and something to kind of step back and say, wow, this is really something. And then when I was in the Peace Corps office, upon arrival, just a few days in, a volunteer came in to the living room on the second floor above the office. And he had this Aussie hat on. He had a kind of a green khaki shirt on, some whiskery stubble, and sweat front and back. And he said, "I just came from Ambrus." And I didn't know what Ambrus meant at that time. It was French. And I knew right away that this Ambrus was a place that I definitely wanted to go to. And so it was a feeling of being, if I can sum up, kind of set down into a place that was like going back in time in many ways. Just so frappant in French, so striking, that I was blown away by the exotica of all of it. The main hospital was arrayed in parallel lines, and then the structures were cement plastered and tin roofed, and the roofs were the result of Schweitzer winning the Nobel Peace Prize and the money he put into re-roofing with tin roofs over the structures. So that gave it more of a modern vibe compared to the Gabonese traditional structures. And then most interestingly was the Village of Lights. Ironically, the leper colony off to the left, which was also referred to as the old hospital, since it wasn't cement plastered, but everything was swept clean, the grounds well manicured. I was there for 2 years and 3 months. The 3 months at the beginning of the time was training, 6 weeks of training in Lambaréni in intensive French, and then 6 weeks of construction training deeper into the interior where we actually worked on building a school. While I was in Gabon, one of my Gabonese French teachers knew of my journalistic forays to the Schweitzer Hospital, and he said he grew up in a village right next to the hospital. And one day he was, as a boy, he was walking through the hospital grounds and he crossed paths with the doctor, Dr. Schweitzer, and he said, "Bonjour, doctor." And Schweitzer said, "Et l'adjectif, mon fils?" And the adjective, "my son." And Jean-Marc, the teacher, said, "Bonjour, grand doctor." So he was known as the grand doctor, kind of coming from his having a high opinion of himself.
While you were there, I know you had the opportunity to interview the head midwife, the Englishwoman who'd actually worked with Schweitzer. What did you learn from her?
She had been misquoted a few times by Western journalists, so she refused to give me an interview. And then after I did three or four journalistic forays there, she heard from others that I had passed the smell check, as in my interviewing the Harvard intern at that time, Dr. Hamilton, and Schweitzer's first nurse from the Netherlands. Anyway, she said in the range of my hearing, she kind of held forth about all these tragedies and so on that had befallen the Gabonese people, and foremost is her telling about the poison wars at one time being so bad due to tribal rivalries, etc., that the dead were coming in so fast and furious that they could only be sewn up in banana leaves and buried in hand-dug mass graves. So many properties of medicines are found in the rainforest, and it's interesting to note that the slash and burn of the rainforest and the clear cutting for timber has shaken out so many viruses as well. You can think of Ebola, and perhaps that Ebola is like nature's way of protecting itself from being eviscerated, and Ebola killed its host so fast. The fortunate thing, that being that spread of it being so fast and the fatality rate being so quick, it didn't spread so far. But the French are doing something right there, in that they're not clear cutting, but rather selective cutting, leaving the precious canopy in place.
You talked about how Schweitzer was seen by the Gabonese, but what did they make of you and the other American volunteers?
There's a saying, "C'est le blanc qui donne le cadeau," the white gives the gift. I had a Toyota Land Cruiser, and I had the preconceived stereotypical weight of being that white who gives the cadeau. But I was just a Peace Corps volunteer surviving on not much money every month. And I was also an American, and the Gabonese love Americans largely because of the Peace Corps. If the Americans had done the colonizing as the French had, then we would have been viewed differently. And there's a saying among the Gabonese that the French works with his finger, the French boss pointing, do this, do that, but the American works with his back. And on that note, we were right there with them, breaking sweat, digging the footings, pouring the floors. So we broke down those stereotypes of the white colonialist and then the latter-day white post-colonial bosses commanding the Gabonese to do all the sweat work. So we broke stereotypes throughout the country through our grassroots work in the Peace Corps. And circling back to some cultural differences, I had to give a dowry, a kind of goat payment. I didn't have much money, of course, being a Peace Corps volunteer. So I had to pay in the form of some sacks of cement as a dowry for the Gabonese young lady to live with me. And the second relationship was more unfortunate because she had some mysterious illnesses and was being treated by the medicine man. And then, quite heartbreakingly, perished while I was out hunting with village friends and had to make the long kind of funeral trek to deliver her casketed body to her people in the provincial capital to show my innocence. And that was smuggled into the novel as well and dealt with more literarily than realistically. But I'd like to think between the two, were there that magic of the imagination merging with reality, creating something sublime, precious, moving, etc.
You had some pretty hairy moments in the jungle.
At one time, I was hunting monkeys out in the rainforest because we had food shortages because the roads would be washed out during the rainy season. And yes, the monkey found its way into the cooking pot like so many other things. Anyway, I was following monkeys trying to get a shot with a 12 gauge I had borrowed from a villager. And the monkeys, of course, were up in the canopy and I was looking above. And when I looked down, I was far away from the maze of elephant trails. And I got all turned around and was lost for 3 days. And on the third day, I shot a wildfowl and ate its uncooked heart. The village chief had a prophetic dream, and in that dream, his dead father told him where he should look for me. And he and his sons and some others found me by the tracks I had left deep in the rainforest. I didn't think I would make it. On the first night, I was surrounded by a group of mandrills. They came up the hill through the bush, charging through the jungle. That I thought there were elephants coming at me. I yelled, and they came around me in two different directions and made a circle. Then there were these grunts all around in a series, like this, They had surrounded me, and some of them were coming closer down the branches, etc. And I would yell and point the 12 gauge. And then they would disappear, and it was dark, and I spent the whole night just kind of frozen, terrified. And then at first light, I got the hell out of there. On the third day, as I said, I was found, rescued, and the whole nightmare of a story found its way into the Voice of Africa, the radio station. The American ambassador knew of it, and when I came to the village, there was a steady stream of villagers coming in to see me that I was all right. Wow. That found its way into the book, like so many other events that kind of vibe with fictional reality.
Your time there has seeped into your novel writing, including Water Drumming in the Soul. Can you tell me about that book?
Water Drumming in the Soul, a novel of race and love in the heart of Africa. I had two serious relationships with Gabonese women when I was in the village of Jiji, which is on the equator, right in the middle of the country. And those found their way obliquely into the novel, which is a love story. And in the end, it's not linear, but rather circumambulatory. And it has multiple interpretations as endings and is, in the words of Nabokov, not simple and sincere, but like the greatest art, deceitful and complex. And I want to say about water drumming, it's quite interesting. It means playing the stream or lake or pond as a drum. And Gabonese women do it. They cup their hands and they push and thrust them in and out of the water while they're singing. And it's quite stunning. And it originated with pygmies in Central Africa, then spread to Bantu. And that opens the novel. David Fields, the Peace Corps volunteer, is entering the village, and then he stops to collect himself, and he hears this water drumming and this singing, and he's drawn deeper off the road and into the bush. And there a stunning Gabonese, or Babanganese, as I say in the novel, girl is playing the stream as a drum, and he's just blown away, drawn to her like a magnet. And over time, love story develops, and he becomes the hunter captured by the game, so to speak. And it's a rollicking game of love with a tension or frisson between the lovers that flows all the way through the book until the heart-wrenching end. It has a lot of first novel heart.
Having been living in this remote area for a few years, was it tough returning to quote unquote normal life in America?
Moving back to the States was kind of rough going. It was like reverse culture shock in that I was living close to nature in Gabon in a very rich cultural milieu, with the dialogue being one of the cornerstones of Gabonese culture. Anyway, going back to the States, it was hard at first to fit in to the economy, to get a good job. And I worked in advertising as a copywriter and an account executive. And then I was there in my hometown of Elgin, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. I got a little bored. And as a writer, like most writers, I had to leave home again. It's like Thomas Wolfe in his book entitled You Can't Go Home Again. And that turned out to be the case in some ways with me. So, as a writer, I struck out for Japan because I had gone through Asia, India, Thailand, Hong Kong, China, then Japan before arriving in the States. And I was quite fascinated with Japanese culture. And that took me to a career as a copywriter for then world's largest ad agency, Dentsu. And I worked on numerous accounts, Subaru, Mazda, Konica, to Sony, Sony no baloney, interesting slogan. I was basically churning out vast amounts of advertising copy for these behemoth Japanese multinational companies. Money was just flowing through the streets and everyone's pockets were jingling. And I was invited out constantly by Japanese people for drinks, dinner, etc. It was such a struggle. The days were long, and I probably broke some records for the amount of copy a gaijin, a foreigner, could write then. This was 1985 to 88, just when Japan had reached its peak and was the richest country in the world at that time, with a little quarter of a city being equal to a few of the biggest states in America. Quite amazing. I did it and I grew from all these experiences. And Gabon, my Peace Corps experience there, made me as a man and a bit of a writer. My education, my bachelor's with a major in journalism and MFA in creative writing in fiction helped make me as a writer, as did my professional copywriting experience. And then after that, I traveled for All Nippon Airways in Flight Magazine Wingspan, doing full features on several different Southeast Asian countries and cultures, now recognizable as my travelogue, Asian Trail Mix, True Tales from Borneo to Japan. And with a German photographer, our most ambitious assignment was trekking across the whole of Borneo to an upriver settlement that the Polish-born English novelist Joseph Conrad wrote about in his Malaya Quartet, the first four books of which Lord Jim is the most famous. Anyway, we traced his trips there aboard the Vidar as a merchant marine out of Singapore to this upriver settlement in the middle of Borneo called Berau. And it was quite mind-blowing in the ambition and scope of the assignment. So that was a seminal essay that found its way into the Joseph Conrad Foundation publication and the Russian University Journal. So it made statement and was again extremely ambitious in scope.
You've had a lot of extraordinary experiences in Africa and Japan. Obviously, you're already an award-winning writer. So what's next on the horizon for you?
What keeps me going is words that I've taken from Gail Godwin, the novelist, and in her novel, The Finishing School, she wrote, "Continue moving and making new tryst with life." Because someone who congeals, you can tell right away that they have settled into their final self. It may be a fine self. They're not moving forward. They've congealed into this final self. Don't do that. Continue moving forward and again making new trysts with life. And that has kept me going through the years following high school graduation until now. And this Monday, I'm going to Cebu in the Philippines for a 10-day vacation, and it may yield a story. And I've been, as I said, all over Asia. And the book, the travelogue Asian Trail Mix, has several travel essays in it. And another book that has broken new ground is Tennis Club Snubbed and Rubbity-Dub-Dubbed, which is kind of an immigrant novel that has tennis as a metaphor for the snubbing, the wicked shiver of the tennis snub that the protagonist experiences when he tries to join Japan's oldest tennis club that started just 2 years after Wimbledon back in 1865 and is still going today. Anyway, I served as a director out there. At the same time, the protagonist is at a Japanese university as an assistant professor, or visiting professor rather, and he's on a limited contract, and then he fights to break through to get a full-time tenured position. That's one novel that breaks new ground. And then my most recent book, Tokyoing, Three Novellas, also breaks new ground in that the first story is about the hero losing face and the things he has to do to show shame and apology in the Japanese tradition. And then how he rises above it. It's an immigrant story. Then the second novella is a persona told from the first person point of view of a Japanese woman struggling with alcohol addiction from nights out after work sessions with colleagues. And she's the only woman in the department. And she really has to fight her way through alcohol addiction and work-related sexism. To sum up, it's a wide breadth of work people can see it with, and all the positive reviews streaming in on my Amazon page, ericmedine.com.
Thanks so much for talking to me, Eric. It's been a really fascinating story.